Good evening, everyone. My name is Diane Riley, and I'm La Trobe Librarian here at the State Library. It's my very pleasant task to welcome you here this evening to the next in the series of lectures given by holders of the State Library's Creative Fellowships. Our speaker is Eileen Channon, who with Stephen Miller was awarded a fellowship in 2006-07. Their project was a comparative study of four very different women, all born in Victoria and all involved in the arts in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. They were Dora Olfson, Louise Hanson Dyer, Mary Cecil Allen, and Clarice Zander. Each of them was an individualist who sought independence when it was not the norm for women, and each made her mark on the history of the arts. Each took on war, modernity, and the social mores of their time to become expatriate pioneers in the international arts world of the period between the two world wars. This fellowship has recently been completed, and I'm sure you will be interested to hear about these four women and the discoveries made in the State Library of Victoria collections and elsewhere by Eileen and Stephen during their research. They have impressive credentials for such a task. Stephen Miller is archivist at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. He has worked in both commercial and public galleries and is currently in Rome, lucky man, for 12 months, researching a biography of the remarkable and controversial librarian to the Vatican under the equally controversial Pope Pius IX from 1846 to 1878. So he's going to be delving into the records of the Vatican. Eileen Channon is the director of Macquarie Galleries, which was co-founded by Basil Burdett in Sydney in 1925. She has been active in the representation, exhibition, and promotion of Australian artists for over 20 years. Most recently, she was appointed Manning Clark House Resident Fellow for 2007 in Canberra. Apart from numerous individual publications, together, these scholarly researchers have published two books: The Art and Life of Weaver Hawkins in 1995, and Degenerates and Perverts, the 1939 Herald exhibition of French and British contemporary art. This was published by MUP in 2005. It was also shortlisted for the Victorian Premier's Literary Awards in 2005 and won the New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards Australian History Prize in 2006. Please join me in welcoming Eileen Channon.
Thank you. Good evening. In this building, a large gathering of art lovers came together almost 82 years ago in July 1925 when the Victorian governor opened a loan exhibition of Australian paintings. It was the first time that an exhibition devoted wholly to Australian painters was held in this gallery and held ever. And the press were very excited by the occasion, as were those who were at the gathering. In the crowd were three women who knew each other: Miss Mary Allen, Mrs. James Dyer, and Mrs. Clarice Zander. They were three of four Victorian expatriates who achieved distinction in the period between the two world wars. They shaped how art was presented, viewed, and accepted. They were born between 1870 and 1893. The fourth, Dora Olsen, worked as a sculptor from Rome, which accounts for not being in the crowd. If she were here, she would have been. She knew Louise Dyer. Louise Hanson Dyer published in Advanced Music from Paris. Clarice Zander publicized art from London. and Mary Cecil Allen worked as critic, educator, and artist from New York. As Diane explained, I've written their biography with Stephen Miller, archivist at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. We're independent scholars with background in art history. Our study was triggered by curiosity about the interwar period, an ambivalent time marked by experimentation and loss of nerve. Australia then has been pictured as a quarantined culture, or so was titled a book, a particular study on Australia at that time. Research for our previous book disproved this picture. Our book, Degenerates and Perverts, chronicled the seminal exhibition which arrived in Australia as World War II erupted in Europe. It examined the forces which cultivated visual culture of that time. Curiosity about the many instances then of Australian artists working abroad led us to our current biography. Our girls, as we call them, have shown that being elsewhere was part of being Australian when being Australian itself was evolving, as was the case during their lifetime. Biographical study requires making clear how the subject or subjects were identified and identified themselves. So crucial to understanding our girls was to know how they saw themselves, who they thought they were. As Anglo-Australian expatriates, where did they see they belonged? Cultural historian Raymond Williams sees culture as an organic way of life that can be social process and common frames of reference for interpreting experience. Culture is group identity and also a site of struggle for dominance by competing groups. These elements are components of the four lives I will briefly introduce you to. And I will also introduce you to some of the common threads that went into their experience, because considering these issues, which they lived through, highlights their achievements. The larger tides of history running through the first three decades of the 20th century are inherent in each of their lives. The contours of the world they occupied altered considerably through their lifetime. Born into the age of imperialism, their childhood was lived within the world of Greater Britain before Australia was shaped. At Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee in 1897, when Dora Olsen was 28, the Queen's subjects in Victoria prided themselves on belonging to Britain and its culture. Colonial girls were presented at court, like Louise Hanson Dyer was in 1907. Our girls watched the celebrations marking the colonies federating in 1901, when, as Barton said, for the first time, there is a continent for a nation for a continent. The concept and experience of being Australian evolved during their lives. The British world was reconfiguring, the imperial world was waning, nationalism took hold. In 1900, there existed only 8 international bureaus, like the Postal Union and the Telegraphic Bureau, only 8. 20 years later, the League of Nations first met in London. An international era was emerging. These women were as much a product of their time as they shaped it. Going back to their origins, they were born into a pioneering society made by gold. Feverish expansion saw Melbourne grow literally overnight into a city the world marveled at. This imbued the Victorian colonials with self-confidence. Progress was their mantra. Advance Australia, the journal of the Australian Natives Association, declared that if the colonial secretary, Joseph Chamberlain, came to Melbourne from London, he would be awestruck because, quote, we would open his eyes with marvelous proof of our amazing advancement, end of quote. Progressivism ran in Victorians' veins, as it did in the veins of our girls. If Victorians were at once Antipodean colonials and British, Dora Olsen's history illustrates there was more to this binary identity. As her name suggests, she was of Danish origin, her family having been dispersed by 19th century wars. Viewing Australia as a new start, and it was at the time advertised in Europe as an Arcadia, Her father migrated from Hamburg in 1849. In 1869, when Dora was born in Ballarat, I'll show you a picture of her birthplace, 100 residents of Scandinavian stock attended a dinner to celebrate the marriage of the Crown Prince of Denmark with the Crown Princess of Sweden and Norway. Her engineer father erected infrastructures to develop the new world. Old world connections anchored his family. Dora spoke German and French. She moved to Germany at the same age as her father had journeyed to Australia seeking his future. Her sights were set on a musical career. When her piano training in Berlin was suspended, she worked in St. Petersburg for 6 years from 1896. That photograph was taken of her in St. Petersburg. A family friend, or family connections, opened a privileged position for her in the Russian imperial capital. A family friend was the engineer responsible for the building of the Trans-Siberian Railway, a project which the Tsar headed and took a close personal interest in. Dora's artistic ability spotted with the Tsarina allegedly buying her painting, Dora settled in Rome in 1902, where she lived for the rest of her life as part of a community of cosmopolitan residents. She began her sculpture career when 33. 5 years later, in 1907, the French government bought her representation of The Awakening of Australian Art, in which Dora personified Australia as New Dawn. During October 1916, while nursing Italian troops, she independently produced one of the first pieces of commemorative sculptural art dedicated to the Anzacs. Dora described her Anzac medal writing, "I have made Australia and her son very young, representing as they do the youngest country and the youngest army." And that is it here. Her medal was sold under the British War Charities Act. Proceeds went to the Australian branch of the British Red Cross Society to assist permanently disabled Australians and New Zealanders. The Prince of Wales accepted the first medal struck. Dora's medal signified both Australian belonging in the British world and Australia's beginnings. I might say, too, that Dora's Anzac medal is among the few surviving examples of her work, and that researching the parallel lives of these four women became intriguing because scant visual and material evidence survived from them, other than from Louise Hanson Dyer, who built for posterity. She only released her publications to public library collections. So sleuthing details about them and their work took us literally, it took us from Ballarat to St. Petersburg, unfortunately not literally to St. Petersburg, but from Carlton to New York. And slender evidential threads we unearthed have identified previously unknown work, particularly by Dora Olson. And we're currently investigating the authorship of a medallion inserted in the entrance of Victoria's Shrine of Remembrance, about which there is mystery and which questionably may be by her. Back to Dora. She depended on patronage. She knew Louise Hanson Dyer, who was an independent, prominent patron, particularly of music and literature. Both she and Olson were equally at home in the different hemispheres of the old and the new. The daughter of a London-born medical entrepreneur, Louise's blood dictated her fate. Her paternal grandfather had been a theatrical entrepreneur in Drury Lane. Her ancestry included a Napoleonic general who became a sous-prefect of Paris. She, too, showed a proficiency for music and abandoned performing ambitions. For a decade, from 1918, she cultivated musical taste in Melbourne, then Australia's federal capital. Initially promoting British music, she opened the Melbourne branch of the British Music Society, responding to a movement begun by English writer Arthur Eaglefield Hull to encourage the production of works by English musicians. Louise premiered performances of music that was unfamiliar to Melbourne, including the first performance in Australia of Gustav Holst's chamber orchestra, Savitri, and Holst's signature piece, The Planets. She encouraged Australian musicians, whom she engaged to play, as when she presented the first concert held in this library in July 1925. She brought to Melbourne music that otherwise would not have been heard by Rameau, Lully, Honegger, Milhaud, Poulenc. And reputation of her benefaction travelled. This library possesses a letter written to her as an exponent of modern music in 1926 from a colleague of Bartók's, asking if she would stage concerts in Melbourne of new music that was impossible to stage in Hungary. She moved to Paris, where in just under 10 years, from 1929, she made her mark internationally, publishing music to the highest standard ever achieved. She named her press the Lyrebird Press. Australia's Lyrebird is known for mimicry. However, Louise Hanson Dyer transformed music culture. She was at the vanguard of the early music revival, such an important feature of modern musical life, which would have been impossible without her contribution. Her publications left scholars in her debt everywhere. Her later recordings of early music left musicians and music lovers in her debt forever. Her international debut occurred in June 1932 through 1933, while Victorians were absorbed with the approaching centenary of the state in 1934. And there is a drawing of the piece with which she made her international debut, which was the complete works of Couperin. Victorians from about 1931 were fixated on the approaching centenary and were criticized for being only statites without any national sense, while Louise bridged the world, publishing Australian, French, and British compositions. And for the centenary, she did this for pipe music, the simplest form of music for Victorian schools. She was a democrat, set to develop musical appreciation, and she did so worldwide. Saluted as the French lyrebird, Max Ernst captured her foresightedness when he painted her portrait in the early 1930s. Clara Sander shared Louise's belief in art's potential for radical transformation. Art gave Clara's the life she sought, centered in London, the world's largest metropolis. As a child, Clarice watched ships leaving from Portland. Distantly related to Sir Robert Peel, her father had died when she was 12, fueling a young girl's idealization of England. She enjoyed a romance with London all her life, first arriving there in 1916 to aid her husband, whom she'd been married to for 4 months before he enlisted with the AIF. Here she is in Melbourne. She's in the center with the parasol. Here she is with her husband just prior to his departure. In London, helping him recuperate. He was Melbourne-born of German ancestry. He was wounded at Fromelles in the first significant Australian engagement on the Western Front. In 1919, they returned to Melbourne. Unable to recover their life together, Clarice returned to London with their daughter, where she lived from 1927. Clarice became publicist for London's Royal Academy. A bastion of the established order, pivotal cultural diplomacy occurred there during 1930s Realpolitik, with Mussolini's Italian art show in 1930, and the British government's involvement in the Chinese exhibition of winter 1935-36. Clarice shaped cultural understanding through this, bringing to her novel appointment at the Royal Academy modern publicity methods, including the first televised broadcast in Burlington House in April 1939. She brought to Australia in 1933 an exhibition of modern British art, the likes of which had not been seen. This is her photographed here at her exhibition. This show prefigured the more publicized 1939 Herald show. It stimulated such controversy and heated discussion about art and culture that the press named 1933 the year of the Zandrian Wars. All four women were cultural globalists whose networks represented the increasing mobility of the day in an era that had not evolved international cooperation. This was the era of air races. Louise regularly attended the International Society for Contemporary Music, begun in Salzburg in 1922, a significant forum where leading contemporary composers met and presented performances of recently composed work. The gathering of the society in 1927 included Bartok, Raymond Petit, Aaron Copland, Mario Castelnuovo Tedesco, Alban Berg. Claris, as a colonial outsider, developed friendships across lines of class and interest. Members of old world aristocracy, like Dorothy and Bertram Freeman Mitford, the third Baron Reedsdale, uncle to the famous Mitford sisters. New age thinkers, like Alfred Orage and his circle of writers and social reformers. Industrialists, like Unilever directors Jeffrey and Lawrence Hayworth and Colin Anderson, who ran the Orient Line of passenger ships. Besides bohemian outsiders, like American and Jewish-born sculptor Jacob Epstein. There is Clara Zander, with Jacob Epstein, about whom in 1933 the Daily Telegraph said, "The man whose doings have the greatest news value of anyone in England, barring the Prince of Wales, is the sculptor Epstein." Belief in a future of international harmony, of humanist values and creative growth glued these friendships, particularly in the darkening 1930s, when diplomatic attempts to halt renewed military conflict were strained by nationalist rhetoric. When Dora Olsen began working, art was based on general consensus of ideas about beauty. By Mary Cecil Allen's day, the advent of modernism had complicated views about art, and the nature of art was hotly debated. Art in this period was in the wars as well. A feature of the interwar decades was the contest between modernism and regionalism. Regionalism that was in turn largely a reaction to accelerating change with accompanying uncertainty. Attuned to new ideas, these women contributed to new aesthetics. Louise Hanson Dyer and Clara Zander both understood publicity was part of modern life and put it to use to advance the arts and develop artistic appreciation and taste. Their enterprises ran counter to existing systems of relationships, largely male-dominated. However, the old order was changing as the shift in dominion relationships with the 1931 Statute of Westminster and Clara's employment at Burlington House show. Their lives mirror the far-reaching changes to the lives of women seen in the first 40 years of the 20th century. Women adopted professions previously barred to them, as Dora did in sculpture, pioneered them, as Clara did at Burlington House, and shaped them as Louise Hanson Dyer innovated publishing and recording music. Clara's experience at the Royal Academy supports art historian Linda Nirkland's argument that art is a process mediated and determined by specific and definable social institutions. The first woman elected to the Academy was Dame Laura Knight in 1936. The Academy had suffered adverse publicity through the 1920s and 1930s, and Clara's achievement was that she was appointed to counteract negative views of the Academy. Mary Cecil Allen's history similarly reflects how attitudes affected women's opportunities. She had written under her own name for the Australian Press in 1926, was much in demand as a lecturer on art, with two books published in New York within a series by prominent authors, had exhibited her painting in Melbourne, America, and at Wembley, and had organized the first international exhibition of Australian art held in the United States in early 1931. This experience surpassed that of most of her Australian contemporaries. So in 1936, she was proposed as the director of Melbourne's National Gallery, then Australia's preeminent museum, richly endowed by the Felton bequest, for whom as well she had been recommended to be advisor. Her difficulty was that, as Martin Boyd described it, quote, there was no greater crime in Melbourne than to be eccentric, end of quote. Martin Boyd narrates how when one society girl, and that is how Mary Cecil Allan would have been regarded, I'll explain why shortly, took up sculpture, she was asked by a friend, but surely you don't mean to do it well? The idea being that this might imply the need to earn money. Allan's independence and achievements shocked Melbourne, where in the 1930s, recovering from the Depression, no room existed for women to compete as man's equal, as she did in America. This status quo, though, was to be shaken. By now, Australia's ties from Mother Britain's apron strings were loosening, and Australia took tentative steps at exploring its own destiny, with Menzies appointing legations in Washington and Tokyo in 1940. From the turn of the century, women had most vocally pressed for social reform and world peace. Mary Allan's parents were both products of Victorian progressivism, from whom she inherited an outlook that supported social reform and world peace. Her father, the son of an English shoemaker who arrived in Geelong in 1854, became dean of the medical school of Melbourne University and was respected throughout the world for his medical education and his work in public health. Her mother arrived in Australia as governess to the daughters of the Countess of Jersey, whose husband was governor of New South Wales. And the Countess of Jersey later served as president for 26 years of the Victoria League. Lady Allan led in community work, including as senior vice president of the Victoria League. The League sprang from women's weariness of the bitterness of the Boer War, illustrating to you how war was very much a backdrop to the lives of these women. Established in 1901, the League promoted closer union within the different parts of the British Empire during the Edwardian period, besides assisting war victims, British refugees, and tending war graves. Later League activities extended to promoting social reform. Mary Cecil Allan was stamped by the communalism, welfareism, and activism which the League fostered. Her perspective expanded through contact in Melbourne with Russian activist and émigré artist Joseph Beal. She was a student here at the National Gallery School, and Beal was a student across the road at the Working Men's College. In New York, she supported the worldwide program for peace through culture, Pax Cultura, led by Russian-born artist and scientist Nicholas Roerich. Roerich was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 1929. The Roerich Pact and Banner of Peace movement, which he initiated, grew rapidly during the 1930s to protect cultural heritage, just as the Red Cross does with hospitals, and so hence the Roerich Pact is often called the Red Cross of Culture. Allan's history illustrates the increasing international character to life that these women experienced and their participation in it. These modern women closely identified with the places where each lived. Allan ran her own school in New York, where she belonged to an artistic community whose members sustained artist colonies like the Cape Cod community of Provincetown. At Formia in 1926, Dora Olson became the only woman ever commissioned to execute a major war memorial for a nation to which she herself did not belong. In Italy, the design of monuments was normally a jealousy preserved right of the Italian-born. Mussolini is reported to have said to her, "You may now be considered an Italian sculptress." However, our women were Australian patriots. Like Melba, they never forgot that Australia's sounds, scents, and sights were the first bars written in the impromptu of their music. Dora, at 57, thought herself young as a sculptor and looked to make work for Canberra, where the new federal capital was to be established. Better known outside her native country, she never realized her ambition to create a substantial Australian commission. There's Mary Cecil Allen. Some of her work. Mary Cecil Allen lecturing here at the National Gallery in 1935. Dora Olson with a portrait she was commissioned to make of Il Duce in about 1923, shortly after he took power. He gave her five sittings in the Chigi Palace. Here she is in her studio at work on her memorial at Formia, which is just outside Naples. A detail of the bas-relief that is on the base, the podium, supporting the figure atop the podium. Dora with a bouquet being presented with the keys to the city of Formia. The official ceremony with Dora, who you can see. The salute from the fascist youth. This is an example of a commission Dora had hoped to make, which was actually for the portico of the Art Gallery of New South Wales. It was to measure 25 feet long, 4 feet high, and the space remains vacant to this day. That is a figure she designed, which is on her tomb in Rome. Dora died in Rome. Mary Cecil Allen died in the United States. Clara Sander and Louise Hanson Dyer both returned home. Louise Hanson Dyer died in Monaco, but at her wishes was brought back to Australia. They all intended always to return to Australia. Expatriation implies being the outsider. Dora was estranieri, a position, a stranger, a position that sharpens awareness of belonging, of being and becoming. Cultural theorist and sociologist Stuart Hall distinguished identity between being with a sense of unity and commonality and becoming, a process of identification. First and foremost, our girls identified with the creative principle. Belief in the creative principle sustained them. Art freed them from confining conventions so that identifying themselves in art became a process for them of imaginative rediscovery of themselves, then the culture of their day. The fresh discovery they brought to their work and the fresh achievements they brought to their work display this. When opportunities closed to them in Australia, they set out elsewhere, truly resilient daughters of their pioneering forebears. Dora was actually called a true daughter of Australia. And you can truly say the same for all of them. The interwar period is known for malaise, decline, and collapse. Their histories are about energy, commitment, creation, and growth. While others stiffened with paranoia or became disengaged as unemployment and the rise of fascism played out around them, these women moved on with life. Mobility, a feature of modernity, marked by modern notions of improvement, was central to their lives, although this tore at their loyalty to their native-born Australia. However, cultural difference sharpened their sense of themselves of Australians, as Australians. Unable to match at home the opportunities they developed elsewhere, they made their mark abroad, always ardent about Australia, always ready to support an Australian and enable Australian ability. And they reflect that identity is a positioning subject to the continuous play of history, culture, and power. As Diane said, they were individualists in an era of waning individualism. They sought like minds whom they knew and worked with, all key figures of the time. They pioneered the arts and were models of individual achievement, resourcefulness, and personal independence. They aimed to rediscover essential humanity within a world of lost values. If their stories are better known, the commitment and humanity that marked their lives may again inspire as it inspired others in their day. Their lives were so rich, and the interwar age they lived in, while bewildering, is so critical, such a critical time, that we have focused on their lives only up to the outbreak of World War II. Our book is a snapshot of that period and the artistic climate of that time. Experiences common to them made their story more than an account of four parallel lives. Narrating their lives offered many stories in one: biography, cultural history, and a chronicle of ideas which shaped an age. When Louise Hanson Dyer launched her press, she announced, "I hope that the lyrebird will be able to extend his wings without any hindrance and fly through time and space, and that propitious winds will allow him to alight wherever he recognizes his native habitat, the land of music." She could be speaking for the land of art for all the three others. Writing their story, Stephen and I traveled, as they did, through space and time on an exhilarating journey, which we'd like to thank the State Library of Victoria for. Our hope is that our book similarly stimulates those who may read it, particularly young women. We hope that young women reading their story may be inspired by the enrichment left to us by these four remarkable modern women of the arts. Thank you.